Hi, everyone. If you could take your seats again, go back to your seats if possible. We'll be starting up the second part of this afternoon's conference. Si vous voulez reprendre vos places, s'il vous plaît. So I would like to introduce our next speaker for the second part of this afternoon's conference. Our next speaker is Emmanuel Licha, who was born in Montreal and who now lives between Berlin and Paris, where he is associate professor at the École Nationale Supérieure d'Architecture de Paris, La Villette. Licha holds a master's degree in urban geography, and he studied visual arts at Concordia University, as well as at l'École Nationale d'Art de Lyon. Licha's work is shown internationally and is held in numerous collections. Most recently, in our province, it was featured at the Musée National de Rimouski, at the Gallery Sporobol in Sherbrooke, and at the SBC Gallery in Montreal. Since the mid-2000s, Licha's work has investigated both the specular and the spectacular dimensions of war and conflict, as well as the means by which such events are represented to foreign audiences, as it were. His 2011 film, How Do We Know What We Know?, shows the behind-the-scenes mechanisms that are involved in TV media coverage of conflict zones. His 2011 film, Mirage, which was screened here last night, looks at the theater of war that was developed in the Californian Mojave Desert in order to train U.S. Army combatants heading for Iraq or Afghanistan. And finally, his 2004 to 2008 War Tourist series, and video installation, actually, which was also, excerpts of which were also shown here last night, tracks how zones of conflict and disaster across the globe become objects of spectacle for a touristic gaze. Licha's talk today, titled On Windows, Camera Frames, and Hotel Rooms, will introduce us to a new project that he's currently working on, which investigates the hotels that journalists stay in while reporting on conflict zones. So let's welcome Emmanuel Licha.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you, Tamar. So I'm going to talk about two projects. One is called Mirage. It's a film Tamar just mentioned, and the other one is one I'm working on. So the first half of the presentation will be fairly structured. The other half is really a work in progress, so I'm counting on you to be aware of this, that, I mean, it's most of what I will show is material I'm using for the research, and some I already shot, but it's really something that is actually in production, so it's kind of a something I'd like to share with you, and it also helps me to think through this project, presenting it while I'm working on it. So maybe what I wanted to say just before starting is, having listened to previous presentations, is well, actually, the two projects I will show are not on war or against war or for war. I'm not an artist who is, you know, for war, against war. I mean, this has nothing to do with what I believe as a citizen. So I will, you know, ask you to look at those projects as neither something that is accusing, for example, the U.S. military or journalists, but rather trying to deconstruct those places, training camps and hotels. And also, and that's why I decided to put last minute this image, which comes from another project. It's called R for Real. And this character is actually, it's me, but it's a character I invented. It's called War Tourist, going to different places of conflicts. And in this case, it was a training camp in France. But I put it because I wanted to to make sure that this presentation will be actually from my point of view, the way I'm looking at conflicts, the way I am presented, images of war, and all this reflection comes really from this experience of being a viewer and a spectator of war. So I will show a brief excerpt from Mirage. So it was shown last night here and in a single channel version. I will show the version, the two-channel version. So I will only show 3 minutes of it.
The intent here is to replicate the battlefield to the best of our abilities, and not just the battle space, but the sights, the sounds, the smells, and the fear and chaos of combat. Make it as real as possible so that it's not new. It's something that's familiar. They can concentrate more on what it is that they have to do instead of the shock of the area itself.
Brian Howe, set designer.
There's a very fine line between the theater here and the theater there than the real thing over there. It's so realistic.
Johnny Wing, actor.
We've actually gotten pictures and photographs, video footage of what these buildings, what these mosques, what these minarets, all these villages look like overseas. So we try to create the same type of setting based on those photos and footage. I typically play the head trauma. Prior to that, I was doing television and film, starting as an extra. This is much different from television and film, but in some ways, certain things parallel television and film. I did some research myself when I had gotten the job to play a soldier. I wanted to know how they talk, how they communicate over the radio, things like this, their phonetical alphabet, just how to communicate so that when I'm out there playing the role, even though I'm concussed and I'm the head trauma, I can try and relay to them that I am for real.
Serba Marcus, born in Baghdad, Iraq, actor.
I'm a role player. I have my role. I'll work for Al Sadr office as a representative for Al Sadr. It's really nice to be here. It's like to be in a movie.
I found the job in Nunanet.
Salim Jabo, born in northern Iraq, actor, age 37.
Yes, I applied for it, they hired me.
We call them role players more than actors. We actually give them a role, a biography, and a name. Their main goal is to interact with the soldiers in the most realistic and culturally correct way possible.
Michelle Crampton, actor's coach.
I just love being here. It's like being in a movie.
So... You understood that this place is a training camp. It's used by the U.S. Army. It's before soldiers are being sent to, were being sent to Iraq and to Afghanistan. So it's a simulacrum. So they go through different experiences there, and the whole thing has been built by Hollywood technicians, professionals. They are, as you saw, set designers, makeup artists, pyrotechnic artists. So they are recreating the ambience, the environment of Iraqi village. And they're also role players. Some are American, others are hired among the Iraqi diaspora. from San Diego, mostly. So I will just show a few images of how this was presented. It was, as I said, a video installation, two screens, and it was installed in this kind of labyrinth inside the gallery where the viewer would go through different steps, and the first one was looking at this image here, which is a video of me seen from the back looking at a report that was made on that training camp, which is I will show an excerpt later. So it was with this installation, this process, important for me to bring the viewers back on my steps, you know, to discover this place as I discovered it. And later they would arrive at this window where they would watch the video. So, you know, I got to this place and, you know, I understood fairly quickly that even though it had been difficult and it took time to get the permission to film there, you know, I was most welcome. There are different elements in this place where which were made to welcome visitors and especially journalists. And one of them is this platform. So it's really like a box in a theater. You are being brought there the first minute you enter the training camp, and they take you there, and this is where you have the best view of the action on the camp. Well, even though you ultimately step down from this platform, everything you will see afterward is has the influence of that place. No, you have been a spectator, like a theater, and looking at the alley as the set and the actors moving about as a kind of performance, which actually it is. So I had introduced myself as an artist and filmmaker, but obviously there was no checkbox for that with the U.S. Army, so they treated me as a journalist, actually. It was very interesting for me to see how the Army deals with journalists. So there are actually various constructions in the camp which are made to accommodate the media workers. So they are built to facilitate their work, but of course they also orient it. So I mentioned this observation deck, and also you will see later a place where journalists stay when they cover this conflict. So this man is called Brian Haw. He's the manager of Fort Irwin's training operations. And he said in the interview that the goal, and I quote, is to make the mock village as real as possible so that when the soldiers actually get for the first time into Iraq or whatever theater they go to, it's not new. It's familiar to them. So their ambition is to have the soldiers, you know, get accustomed to what they will later discover in Iraq. And he also mentioned the work of the set designers, and he said, and I quote again, they bring back their pictures and their knowledge. We also do research online to get very real pictures of the environment. We then put together a model of what we think it should look like. So it's a very particular and skewed interpretation of Iraq that soldiers will discover when they go there, especially if they are insistently told that what they see during their training is what they will discover in Iraq. So he said, we then put together a model of what we think it should look like. So I think he meant that it was the camp, not the village. But suddenly I was amused thinking that it could actually be it could be Iraq itself, no? So actually what they built there would be what they would like Iraq to look like. So the model they built would then represent a kind of fantasized Iraq that would exist instead of its reality. So a kind of very safe Iraq. When something goes wrong, they could stop and, you know, stop the action and start over. And as it happens in Fort Irwin, the ice cream truck would come and give ice cream to the soldiers and to the extras. So I will be looking at different characters into that have a role in this this place. So I'm looking at this training camp not only as a place where soldiers train for war. Of course, they learn how to run, how to shoot a sniper, all those things. But they also learn how to look. So it's also optical training. So the soldiers do learn how to recognize terrorists, and of course, terrorists look like everybody. So potentially, everybody in this village is a terrorist. So this is something that they learn very soon. And they also learn to deal with journalists, because journalists come there and they interact with them. They are another set of characters in this camp, which are the extras. So, for example, you have two examples there, that they are dressed in this strange way. Actually, even though they're Iraqi, they probably never dressed like that in Iraq. So they are all Americans, and they, by, you know, working there with the U.S. Army, they participate in the war effort of the country they adopted. So they are pledging allegiance to their new country by personifying, for example, potential terrorists. So it goes through a caricature, and this caricature is a kind of symbolic betrayal of their home countries. So, and also by looking at the action of the militaries, their participation to this mise-en-scène also functions as an approval of what they see. So there are about 1,800 role players, and approximately 250 are what they call FLS, foreign language speakers. So they are there also to teach soldiers some, you know, basics of Arabic. And of course, they probably think that Iraq and Iraqis do not look typical enough, so they dress in this strange fashion. I will show you a very interesting excerpt from this report. I'm looking at in the installation. So it was made by CBS, KCAL9, a local television network in California. There's this interview of one role player, and the man tells the journalist that he left Iraq in 96 because there was no freedom in the country, and then worked for the U.S. Army to contribute to the good things that the Americans do for Iraq. And so I will show the excerpt. Went too fast. So if it wasn't sad, it would be hilarious. Oops, I'm sorry. It's just a bit sensitive. I'm having trouble with my...
You know, Pat, they brought in actual, you know, set builders from Hollywood to create a lot of this. They brought in makeup artists from Hollywood to help them in their recreation as they do their reenactments 24/7 when they have troops here.
Well, Pat, it's a very serious role they play out here in preparing our troops to go overseas and face adversity. And joining me now is a guest who helps those troops train. His real name is Nasser. All of his friends call him Botan, so that's what we're going to call him. He's actually from northern Iraq. You're Kurd, right?
Yes, sir.
And you've been here for how long?
13 years, sir.
And how did you get involved with this, Botan?
Actually, in 96, I left the country because, you know, this country, there's no freedom in Iraq. Regime's very dictators, no freedom, no equal. And then I left the country.
And what led you here to Fort Irwin?
Actually, I was interested, you know, the job over here. You know, I try to work with the army, do good things for this country.
And what is your role here at the camp?
Actually, I'm police chief. from Madinat al-Jabal.
Of the Iraqi police.
Iraqi police chief, yes,
I can see by your
this is the Bashar, this is the flag from Iraq, this is the, they call them police, and by Arabic and by English, police and Shorta.
Uh-huh.
Yes, sir.
So what kind of roles do you play when you're acting out your role as police chief? What goes on?
Actually, I got a lot of stuff to do over here, working with the, my guys over in the, from the town, and I work with the IRT, like I mean brute force, always work together.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. You know what? Everybody here, I know they appreciate it. And I also want to mention one more thing to our viewers. You just got some big news last month, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
Tell everybody at home what happened.
Actually, I feel so happy. I become citizen from this country just like somebody else. The best thing is I got kind vote, you know, right to vote.
Hey, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You're very welcome, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you, Motad, for taking
very
the
welcome,
time
sir. Thank you. Thank
I
you.
Appreciate
all
it very
right,
much.
Sir. Thank you.
So, I mean, when you look at this image of this tall journalist leaning over this little man, totally intimidated by the journalist saying yes, sir, every question and answers, you have kind of system that is put into place by the journalists and also by the entire army there. And I also find very interesting this moment where this role player announces that, you know, he just obtained a U.S. Citizenship, and the journalist establishes a connection between working for the army and gaining access to U.S. Citizenship. So, the role of role players in acknowledging visually by participating, by dressing, by looking at the action of the military, so acknowledging the action of the U.S. Army is quite critical in this context. And, of course, there is this other element that is involved in the acknowledgement, the visual acknowledgement of what is happening and participating in this optical device that is this training camp. And although he and she is not present there, it's the spectator itself, but it is present through the work of journalists who come to cover the activities of the camp. There is an interesting example in the same report where even though they are reporting from this training camp, and they actually always mention it, they never say that they are in Iraq, they are using the same visual dispositive as normal media would use when they cover a conflict. For example, you have those two journalists in the studio. They are interviewing or in conversation with the journalist who is, you know, on the field, and later there's a full frame of the journalist, and those letters, those words appear live, so we know he's, you know, actually speaking, you know, live from the position where he's at. And I put those two images together just to compare, you know, how it is treated. So this one is live from Baghdad, and the other one is actually live from Fort Irwin. And then later, you know, you have this split screen, again, the journalist live from either Baghdad or Fort Irwin, who speaks with the two presenters or the two journalists in the studio. And the graphic design usually quite dramatic, you know, training the troop, reporting Iraq violence. So looking at this, that's why also I'm using, talking about training the viewer, you know, this optical training, because, this kind of framing operations that Butler also mentions, which is done in silence. You know, of course, they never say we will do like if you were in Iraq, but looking at those images, the viewer will probably get accustomed to and probably mix the two. Either it's from Fort Irwin, which is a simulation and it can stop and it's at any moment and it's safe. And when going back to images of Baghdad, probably will remember what they saw from Fort Irwin and could make a confusion between the two. So I was wondering, I mean, is the image on the right from Kcal a kind of rehearsal for the image on the left from this CNN report? So reporting actually from Fort Irwin could be considered as a real-scale training exercise for journalists, technicians, military, and spectators as well. So I mentioned the place where journalists stay. This is in this building. It's actually the most developed building. It's the only functional building in the camp. So I was staying here, over there, in this room. And this is what it looks like from inside. So you see this window. I measured it, and it has the exact proportion of a TV screen, 16 by 9. So you just sit on the bed, and what should be filmed is already framed for you. Okay, so I will see that time flies. So I will now enter the uncertain zone of my presentation, which is so this is what I'm working on at the moment. It's called the Hotel Machine. So it really, the idea really came from this, you know, being there for a few days and just wondering how come the army thought it was, you know, necessary to put a hotel in a war environment. I mean, in a simulation, which costs a lot. We don't suspect the U.S. Army to have lots of humor, so I don't think it's a joke. I think they really consider it's part of the landscape and it's important. So from this experience, I thought, oh, maybe it is important, so I should go and look at those places. So that's how the idea of the new film, Hotel Machine, came. So I will present quickly, or maybe not that quickly, those hotels, so, and you will quickly understand what they have in common. So all these hotels are hotels that were used by journalists when they covered the conflict. So for every conflict, journalists go en masse to the city, and they usually stay at the same place. So there are different reasons, different scenarios to that. Sometimes they have to stay at the same place because the regime forces them. It was a case during the first Gulf War. It was the case recently in Tripoli. Sometimes they stay together because they need to have access to technology. It was the case in Sarajevo, which, you know, the Holiday Inn in Sarajevo was the only big place that could accommodate so many journalists, and also they had to use satellite phones, etc., and they were all in that that place. It was also the only place that could have access to water and food, etc. Sometimes they choose it because they have a great view on the scene where the conflict or the battles are happening. It was the case recently in Cairo, where the journalists stayed in the Ramses Hotel. So the film will consider all those situations, and I made the choice to not talk about each individual hotel, but rather mix them all. So there will be about five hotels and with different scenarios, as I mentioned, but the montage will blend all of them together, and you will never actually know where you are, if you're in Beirut or Sarajevo or Baghdad. It will only be shot from inside, so you will never see the facade. For example, the photos I showed you, you will never see them in the film. It will always be inside. So I'm talking about something like a meta hotel. I will also use archive image because I'm going after the fact in time of peace. So nothing is happening. It's really boring. Hotel, as you know, even if it has been a war hotel, and now it's nothing more boring than this. They're usually like four or five star hotels, so they look all a little bit the same. So for example, this is the type of image you might have in the film. So the room today and with some archive material broadcast on the monitor. So this film will be my first feature-length film. So it has to go through means of production of cinema, which is completely new to me. So they ask crazy things from me, like a teaser. Never made a teaser. So it's completely ridiculous, but I will show it to you.
Something is happening outside. Peter Arnett, join me here. Let's describe to our viewers what we're seeing. The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. We're seeing bright flashes going off all over the sky. Peter?
Well, there's anti-aircraft gunfire going into the sky. We hear the sound of planes. They're coming over our hotel. However, we have not yet heard the sound of bombs landing, but there's tremendous lightning in the sky.
So without scruples, I used all I could find, you know, and archive some of material I shot myself, some fiction films you probably recognize, Life from Baghdad or other themes that will appear as archive material on the external monitor of the hotel. The film will be divided in different zones, which correspond to different type of gaze, the way, you know, since these are places from which we journalists look at war. It's also a place where they meet other protagonists of the conflict, where they exchange information. That's also sometimes where peace agreements are signed. People take refuge in those hotels. So actually, the U.S. Army was right. It is an important element of the warfare landscape. So I will show some of the working material divided into these different zones. So the first one being the intended gaze. So these would be the conference rooms, the windows, the balconies, the rooftops. So this is a rooftop in Baghdad. Journalists use them to, you know, do their live coverage. So we are used to this type of image, except usually we don't see the camera. This is a series of images that were made by a journalist who was very proud. I met him, he was in Benghazi and he was a little sick, so he didn't follow his colleagues into the little pension, but he needed some more comfort, so he stayed in a good hotel, and from there he was able to make this photo from his balcony. And of course, it appeared in the teaser, this very famous CNN broadcast during the first Gulf War. So I will just have
this. This is something is happening outside. Peter Arnett, join me here. Let's describe to our viewers what we're seeing. The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. We're seeing bright flashes going off all over the sky. Peter?
Well, there's anti-aircraft gunfire going into the sky. We hear the sound of planes. They're coming over our hotel. However, we have not yet heard the sound of bombs landing, but there's tremendous lightning in the sky.
So you probably all remember those images that were shot from the Al-Rashid Hotel, and it was one of the first moments in history where we could have live coverage of war as it was happening and seen from the hotel by the journalist. And of course, there are also very famous episodes like the one that happened in 89 in Beijing, where this man was stopping the tanks, and the day before, the journalist had been put into custody in this hotel on the right, the Beijing Hotel. But that was a big mistake, actually, from the regime, because it was a great vantage point, a great place from where to see what happened. So there were different photographs that were taken by four different photographers, plus the video footage from the BBC up there. So they were, they all talked a lot about these images. So that's how I found, I can become very nerdy with this work, like trying to find on which floor they were, etc. It's kind of a, I told you, it's a working material, so I'm allowed to be a bit nerdy. But actually, so they all seem to be the same pictures, but they were, the two that were on the fifth floor, they were actually on the same balcony, taking the picture. And recently they discovered another picture, and we see the man here. And of course, you never saw this picture. I've never seen it, because it's not as spectacular as the other one, but actually it shows much more things happening around the action. And I mentioned the Ramses Hotel in Cairo, and journalists were staying in this hotel until journalists often think that they're always amazed when the hotel is attacked. They think they are safe where they are, and no one can touch them. But actually, pro-Mubarak mob starting attacking the hotel, and something that was unusual. The Sheraton, Ramses Hilton, I can't remember. Just expelled the journalists because it became too dangerous. People were attacking the hotel because journalists were staying there. Obviously, they were not in favor of the poor Mubarak. So there was a big scandal, and later the administration decided to let the journalists be in the hotel, but they told them they should leave their camera at the lobby, like in Western, when you leave your gun, at the lobby. So they could not go in the rooms with their cameras. Again, a nerdy thing I did was to look at about more than 500 images that were shot of the Tahrir Square, and trying to find where they were taken from. So I identified four hotels. So the Ramses there, the Arabesque Hostel, Ismailia House Hotel, and Intercontinental. So almost, 90% of the aerial images made of Tahrir Square were made from those four places. Other examples,
This is what it's like on the receiving end. Last night, a square mile in central Baghdad seemed like hell on earth. An inferno. ITV News cameras recorded the barrage from hotel balconies, and it was a truly chilling sight. This is going to be a big bang. This is on a completely different scale from everything else that has gone before.
So I find this journalist docking, although he's certain he's quite safe, he becomes the interface between us, the spectator, and the violence in the background. And, miming this kind of danger makes us, be with him, and we really do think that he's over there for us, and, risking his life for us. So I see time is So I will stop with my... I don't know where to stop, actually. So I could go briefly through some images. Like, maybe do I have like 2 more minutes? Okay, I will finish like this. So this woman working at the Holiday Inn who showed me images of the hotel when it was destroyed, because you can see war from the hotels. Exactly, the pro-Mubarak mobs understood that it's also a place you should attack to cease all these broadcasts of images. So it's a two ways, and of course there are many stories of hotels being attacked. So I will not go through all this material, but these are video footage of some bombings in Baghdad. I think it would be too long if I start with the second zone. There are 5. Can you imagine? I told you. Told you I was too much and I was a nerd. So I will stop here. Thank you.
Just curious to know what the other gases are called.
The other what?
What the other gases are called.
Yes, I can go through my images. So fortuitous gaze is the second one. So this is the entrance of the hotel, the lobby, parking zone, reception desk. So this, the corridors, the elevators where, you know, journalists meet randomly other people. Don't remember all of them. Third zone is self-reflexive gaze, so the hotel rooms where, you know, journalists write their report or watch other images. And actually, I put an image of those 2 employees of the Holiday Inn in Sarajevo whom I met, and they told me something that was quite interesting, because they said, you know, it was very interesting for them to work in the hotel during wartime, because they were the first to know what was happening in the rest of the country, because they could, you know, sneak into the... I mean, they were friends with the journalists after all those years, and they could watch, you know, the footage they would gather from other places in the country or in Sarajevo. So images do come back into the hotels, you know, through... monitors or through the monitors the journalists use. Then there's the zone 4, which concerns all the machinic aspect of the hotel. So a hotel is a place which has to function to broadcast images, but also to provide food, to provide technology, of course, and, you know, safe environment. So the film will show all these zones, like the laundry, the kitchens, that make. And since it's filmed now, it will also hopefully give the feeling that, you know, hotels are, you know, preparing for the next war. And actually, it is the case. I was in July to shoot some material in Beirut last July, and, you know, with this crisis, this thing happening in Syria, journalists were starting to come back to Beirut, and of course there's always this risk that it would expand to Lebanon. So the hotel where I was, which was used during the civil war and also in 2006, was in a way getting prepared for the next conflict, and to welcome more people. And the fifth is the social gaze. So these are the bars, the lounges, the restaurants, the swimming pool. So all the places where, you know, journalists also meet. And some of them, you know, told me that they were actually some that covered the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for years do it because the hotel in Jerusalem is so wonderful. And that was my images to finish the presentation, and it looks very wonderful. Yeah.
Fascinating. Thank you.
Someone else, maybe? Yes.
Thank you. Emmanuel, I'm curious about your own framing and screen strategies that you undertake in order to reveal the construction of the gaze of war. In particular, your strategies around single screen versus multiple screen strategies. Because looking at your work, I was intrigued by, I was started thinking about screen theory and like the objectness of the screen and the ways that artists in the 70s were bringing our attention critically to the screen, like Michael Snow and Bruce Nauman, of course. And I guess I was wondering, in your work, you make us very aware of screens and windows and framings and lookouts. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your strategies for multi-screen installation versus single-screen cinema kind of environments.
Thank you for your question. I'd be tempted to let the art historian answer. No, I won't do that. But actually, I mean, for example, in the example of Mirage, you know, there's this image I showed me looking at screen, computer screen, and inside the screen there's a frame. You know, it's not full screen, the image I'm looking at. It's a smaller frame. And, of course, the spectator is, so to speak, behind my back looking at, over my shoulder, what I'm, the artist who is doing the rest of the proposition is looking at. So, I mean, this question of, you know, framing, I mean, for example, this example, I might only speak about that, was very important for me to, as a warning to the viewer that everything they will see from now has been framed, you know, by me, and it's usually not a warning that is made by journalists. The tone of the voice, the voiceover, the way it's presented usually gives the impression that we are in front of truth. So I wanted as I said, to put the spectator back into my steps and to understand, you know, how I approach this this space, the training camp, and so, yeah, most important is that it's one interpretation and a clear framing. In Hotel Machine, there will be, maybe you saw this image of the journalist sitting in the pub and the sound designer in the back. So for very brief moments, this is also something I would like to show that will appear, like the production team around this gathering of images. I'm also using someone that you never see or rarely see in media reports, which is the fixer. He's the guide for journalists, also the can be the driver, the translator. He's the one who makes you know, people speak. And some of the interviews I made with fixers, you know, they were not ashamed to say that when they don't like the question of the journalist, they just transform it. And when they don't like the answer, they will transform it also to police. He's my interface. You know, I'm using real fixers, people who worked as fixers during the war. So I'm re-employing them now in time of peace to articulate this interface between now and the time of war. And also, of course, by making him the main character of the film, I'm also unveiling some of the tactics used by journalists. So,
can I ask one question? Yeah. Okay. Good. Thanks. I mean, I don't know exactly how the film, which I mean looks just amazing, how it's going to look like.
So, me neither.
But I was thinking in the end about last night and the way that you were exploring. Just to continue with Cheryl's remark, you were exploring the five monitors in the showing of the which film of war tourism, right? And so showing war tourism in five screens. And as I mentioned to you also last night, and I just wanted to kind of push this a bit and making perhaps a connection with Rosalind Deutsch's talk, is that when you have the five screens, I mean, if you just had one screen, in a way, you would be looking into the runes, let's say, the marks of a past war, okay? And you would be brought by perhaps a guide, and you would be looking at it. And as a spectator looking at the screen, you would just kind of follow then the narrative of the guide who's showing, you know, the runes of a recent but past war. And but when you bring in the five screens, what's kind of interesting is that you start to become aware, in a way, of your own gaze. You enter into the story of each guide, but at the same time, you start to realize how easily you sort of surf from one place to the other, and you start to realize your own inevitable and inescapable, in a way, condition of being a tourist. And it's something that is really difficult and impossible to get rid of. I mean, if each time that you go somewhere to look at something, you are, in a way, a tourist, which implicates a certain distance, which can also implicate a certain pleasure through voyeurism, whatever. And I thought that it could be interesting to make this connection with what Rosaline was actually bringing in, which is the question of the bad, you know, the badness, you know, of our unconscious. And in a way where you're not, as a spectator, what's kind of interesting is that you're not necessarily just put merely into a position of being guilty of your gaze, because that would, I mean, that would be a dead end, it seems to me, but in a way more of realizing that condition and then starting to reflect upon that. What does it mean then? What does it mean that I will always be caught in a certain way with the touristic dimension, because there's no way of going out of it completely. The journalists are also tourists, right? In a way, in a globalized world, we're increasingly tourists. And so what is it then to be tourists, and what is it to do? What can we do with that, you know? Especially in these situations of acknowledging or trying to know, you know, war.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would maybe go back to your question to make a link more than the question of the number of screens. I would rather refer to the question of installing the work in space and having the spectator move, you know, from one zone to the other. And what I forgot to mention is Hotel Machine would be a feature-length film, but there's also installation version, which, you know, something is important for me to have the viewer move from one space to the other, and these spaces will correspond to these different zones, those of ways of gazing at images. In the case of War Tourist, I think it was extremely important for me that the viewers move. And yesterday's experience screening the work was terrible for me. I mean, it really, really doesn't work. No, I'm sorry, I accepted your invitation, but it doesn't work. Not to look at one after the other like this. I mean, for me, what's more important is that the viewer moves, and it would answer the question of the ethical position. It's very different works, but Renzo Martins, you know, it raised, you know, when you presented it, this question of the ethical position of the artist. In a way, you know, doing this, inventing this character of war tourist. Of course, it's something I've done myself. You know, when I first got to Sarajevo, I did go and see the ruins. I mean, I had a good pretext. I'm an artist. It would be difficult to go in Sarajevo and not look at this. And all this involves the body, you know, moving from one place to the other. So I really wanted the spectators to do that themselves, reproduce these actions and looking at one screen, and the question of the ethical position of the artist becomes irrelevant at that moment, because the viewer is himself or herself involved in the same condition of, you know, consuming those images and wanting to see something more and being bored by some images and etc. So I would think of, I mean, this can also happen in film, of course. I mean, we can sit in a theater and all of this is happening. No, we know that that works. It's just I'm not so experienced at doing it. For me, it's really a question of moving from one zone to the other and involving the spectator in this these movements. Thank you.